This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Andy Doe. He's one of the pioneers of the digital music industry. He ran iTunes' classical music business. He worked for a company called Naxos as COO, and he now runs his own business called Proper Discord LTD, helping artist labels and other kinds of organizations sell music. Andy, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's really a pleasure. The reason that you caught my attention for people who are listening is that you wrote a blog piece that was picked up by a website called New Music Box, which is a really interesting piece that you called What is Going On with the Record Industry? And I just thought that there are so many things that you said that apply to or could be discussed as contextually in the same way as we talk about books, that you're, and I thought your perspective would be really valuable for people in the book business to hear. So I'm really happy to talk to you.
Well, thank you. I should probably open with a disclaimer that I've never worked in the book business and don't know much about the way it works. But if there's something we've learned from music that can be applied to books, then I'm very happy to share it.
Well, often people in the book business have looked at music because as a kind of model, I think mainly because digital hit music, the music business, more earlier and in a more immediately disruptive way.
Right, yes, it's pretty hard.
Yeah, and there are differences, significant differences, although people in the book business worry about piracy. In the record business, piracy is a predominant concern when you talk about digital. So, but we tend to think of things that happened in the music business might happen in a slightly different way in the book business, so that what we can learn from music might help us.
Right, it's the ghost of book business future.
Yes, very well put. So you listed 10 things, and I thought this was, you know, some of your observations were valuable. I think for those of us in the book business who work with writers, publishers, organizations that are trying to figure out how they can sell more books or distribute more of their content in digital forms. And some of the things you said, I thought, were very pithy. I don't think we need to, you know, obviously people can go read this for themselves, so we're not going to talk about every single thing. But one of the things you said really caught my attention, and that is, I thought that you said it does not matter how the market is doing, stop asking. And I thought this was really interesting, because it is a tendency that people have, every one of us has, to look at how is our business doing overall, like what is happening in the book business, what's happening in the record business. And I thought you were, that was really a brilliant observation to say you can do that, but it's not going to help you in figuring out what you need to do.
Well, I might be completely wrong about this, because after all, if what's going to happen is the entire book business is going to disappear, if that's what's going to happen, then it doesn't matter what you do. No one's going to read your book. But it seems incredibly unlikely to me that that is what's going to happen. And just because something is heading towards zero doesn't mean it's going to reach it. I mean, people are still making tapes. They're still pressing vinyl. CDs might be in decline, but it seems incredibly unlikely they'll ever, or that they'll go away in the foreseeable future. And it just seems like, even if it's not a totally fruitless question, it seems to me to be the wrong question to obsess about if we're going to obsess about something. And really the question we should be obsessing about is, how do I sell more of my stuff? How do I get the content I can produce to the people that will love it, and how can I earn a living doing that?
That's right. I think those are the same questions that writers and publishers have to think about. It isn't how other people are doing, it's what can you, I mean, you do care about how everything is going because it creates a context, but within which you operate, but there's your books are what matter. And I think the people who have been successful have been the ones who are more obsessed with their own books than they are with everyone else's.
Right, but it's difficult to write commentary that encourages people to think of their own content as unique and to give people advice that's useful, regardless of which of the many ways of bringing it to market might be most suitable to them. And so instead, we obsess about this one big question: how's everything doing?
Well, let me just as a kind of side question to that: your experience is in classical music. Is that correct?
Right. Yes.
Mostly.
Yes. So classical music. This is a genre which has been battling with rumors of its own decline for at least 600 years.
Yeah, and it's actually strikes me as kind of almost amazing that you've been, you know, this is again my confessing my own ignorance of the music business. I know the classical music business is what it is, or that it's there, but I never really understood its scope and, you know, how one would be successful in it, which obviously you do, and you know, probably the things you know in your business do have corollaries to how people sell fiction, for example. You know, people who are in trade nonfiction think fiction is impossible. They can't figure it out. I'm sure that rock and roll guys who are used to selling huge quantities look at classical and say, how can you make any money doing that?
Right. It's in some ways, it is a struggle to make money selling classical music. It might be less subject to trends. Often things survive in catalogue in a way that they don't in other genres of music. It is a relatively small part of the overall music business. In the US, only about 3% of the records that are sold are classical. But this still all adds up to a business just of classical recordings worth about $1 billion a year.
Yeah, so there's some good business there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so the reason I asked that is that you, one of the other things that you said, which I thought was really important, is that you have to ask yourself, why should this record exist? And of course, there's a difference there, it may be, I think, between a book and a piece of classical music, because in many cases with music, many other recordings may already exist of the same piece. So you have to say to yourself, what am I going to do that's going to make this better or different or enough of a reason for someone else to want to buy it? But in another way, writers have that same challenge, or publishers have that same challenge. Why should you publish this book? What is the reason you're doing it? What differentiates it from 50 other books that were published last week or that you might look at next week? And I think that uniqueness or whatever is compelling about it is how you create your marketing. It informs how you create your marketing. It informs why you are publishing the book or making that piece of music in the first place. I think that's what you were implying when you asked that question.
Well, I think that the root of this question is in a frustration that I used to have when I was working at iTunes. My job was to listen to the new classical recordings that came out and pick which ones we would promote. And promotion on iTunes isn't paid for. Sometimes there's some exclusive content. We might have conversations about co-promotion. But basically, the promotion's free and is done on an editorial basis. And so I would have to listen to maybe 700 new classical releases each month and decide which ones to promote. And, of course, the salespeople would call me up and say, hey, we've got this new recording of this person performing this. Will you promote it? And I would always ask them, why did you make this record? And it amazed me how few people could answer that question. Why did this need to exist? And, you know, it's certainly true that it's very easy in classical music to produce obviously derivative work, because You know, Mozart's been dead for a long time. We've been recording all of Mozart's music over and over again. It's easy to say this CD of Mozart's last three symphonies is not substantially different to all of these other recordings of Mozart's last three symphonies. With a book, it's easier to see that the words are different, but I think you could make a good argument that some books can be equally, if not more, derivative.
Yeah, I think it would be a challenge to ask a writer, you know, what is the reason that this book needed to exist? Because it's kind of an internal reason. It's a, you know, that's more of a question that you would ask a composer rather than a record label, let's say.
But here's the difference then. If the book is the composition, the first copy of the book is the composition. As a publisher,
right,
you need to be able to answer the question.
That's right. But see where it gets...
Why does this book need to be printed lots of times?
That's right. That's right.
Why does this performance of this piece of music need to be recorded lots of times?
Right, but
pressed onto a CD and shipped to warehouses and marketed and advertised, sent to reviewers. Why are we going through this whole rigmarole? And if the answer to this question is because that's what we do, then that's fine in an industry that doesn't change at all and in a market that's not path dependent, where you can't oversaturate it. But that's not the situation that certainly the music business finds itself in, where we've sold a lot of records to people. People own a lot of records, particularly classical record collectors. They've got these huge collections. They have access to the catalogue. And the market's changing, so we can't simply assume that something that used to work will continue to work, and that is a thing that gets done. It was an answer I heard a lot. Why are you releasing this? That's what we do.
Well,
that's not our answer.
Well, no, I think a similarity, at least that I've observed in publishing and marketing books, is if you ask either the publisher, the editor, or the self-publishing author, not as a challenge so much as just a point of information, who do you think will read this? What is the market for your book? Who are your readers?
Right.
It's a question that oftentimes the person you ask can't answer.
But that's to a self-publishing author, that's probably a softer question to ask, a softer way of asking basically the same question.
That's exactly right. And are there equivalent? I mean, this is again a side question, but I assume in classical music you have the same circumstance that we have with books or any music, and that is the barrier to entry. And you mentioned this a little bit in your piece. It is possible to make a record for very little money. It is possible to produce a book today for an amount of money that's not, I mean, it's not zero, but it's pretty low compared to what it was 5, 10, 20 years ago, or even 2 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I've put out digital books, and that's not expensive. It's probably cheaper than making a record.
Maybe
not cheaper than the $12 record I made, but...
No, not cheaper than that. I love that idea. In fact, that would be difficult to do, although if you did it, I think that if you used iBooks Author, the Apple software, and Amazon has their own, and Barnes & Noble Nook has their own self-publishing tools. I think it is actually possible. If you were talented enough to make your own cover that looked decent, it is actually possible to make a book for free. That doesn't include the writing time. It doesn't include editing, which I think is really critical. You know, it would be like having a musician record it live without any engineering. You know, you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah, but you need your computer. You and your computer, and you can put a book out. So the barrier to entry is low.
Yeah, it is pretty low, which of course creates its own set of issues for all of us, and that is because it creates so much content that as consumers we have difficulty figuring out how to find the things that are interesting out of all of the number, huge amount of things that are out there. Even just the idea of sampling, you know, you could spend so much time listening to 15 or 30 second samples of music or reading the, you know, they give you maybe 2,000 or 3,000 word sample, which is great. And I think is really wonderful, but I can't sample everything and you can't listen to every piece of music. So that's one of the, that actually is one of the sort of commonalities, I think, between music and books and video in particular, which, you know, with YouTube, with literally hundreds of millions of people creating videos, we have hundreds of thousands of books being produced and hundreds of thousands of people recording music, making it very interesting.
Right. Well, and if you imagine a small independent bookshop, right? Somebody can walk in. I walk into even quite a small bookshop, and I get a little bit scared. I think, you know, there's some words on the spine that just hide hundreds of thousands of other words on the inside, and there's absolutely no way I can walk around this place and choose the ones I want to read and leave. And I get into a panic and I give up, and I do almost all the books that I buy have cropped up in the bibliographies of other books. Whereas my wife could somehow walk into a bookshop and come out 15 minutes later with 10 books, 5 she's going to really enjoy and 5 that I'm going to really enjoy. And that's amazing. But you think as the bookshop gets bigger, it gets harder and harder to do that. And it is true of the record store as well, that if it trends towards an infinite size, it becomes less and less likely, until it's impossible, that the consumer walking in is through luck or judgment going to pick up your book and walk out with it. And if it is the case that you can't count on people going into the shop and stumbling upon your stuff anymore, then you have to have a plan for how you're going to go and get them and tell them about your stuff. You can't count on the store to do it until you have a bestseller. You can't count on the store to do it. You can't count on reviewers to do it because they're flooded with content. You have to identify your audience and figure out a way to go and talk to them.
Yeah, I think in that way, both books and music are facing the same challenge and having to learn a new way of marketing, you know, that didn't exist before. Up until a few years ago, you had a kind of store-based marketing system, as you're describing it, you know, especially with new books or new music. If it's in the store on display, people can come in and look at what's just come out. But when there's this much stuff and fewer stores, less space, infinite a number of units stocked in online stores, but no browsing possible. You know, the idea is that you do have to go out and find people and build relationships with them to tell them about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so in the music business, I mean, in the book business, this has been difficult for publishers. It's difficult for authors because they're not used to it. And for a variety of reasons, there are challenges as well, because if you're a publisher of multiple, you publish a wide variety of books. And I think even in the music business, even though you might be a classical music label, which gives you a verticality, an audience that really, they understand what you do, they're likely to know you and they also, you know, the same music well. So you can have those conversations because you're coming to each other with a common language.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is where a label or a publisher, if they're small enough and focused enough, can be incredibly valuable. I think, you know, people often ask me, what do I need a label for? And one of the things that a label can do is introduce you to their loyal customer base. But it doesn't work when the label is very, very small, because the loyal customer base is very, very small. And it doesn't work when the label's very, very big, because it doesn't say anything about your music to be signed to Universal.
That's true.
Because, you know, they put out, you know, they got, what, 30% market share. They put out everything. They put out hip-hop and they put out the Berlin Philharmonic. All it tells you about somebody's music if they're signed to a huge label is that at some point somebody committed significant resources to making this into a commercially going concern.
So in the music business, do you think, as I think a lot of people in books do, that this, what you've just described, means that, because not every writer is going to be able to find the perfect publisher or every musician find the perfect label, that the responsibility then falls back to the creator to create these narratives and conversations and build audiences. I mean, the way it's discussed with authors is that they have to have platforms. That's what, you know, I assume that's similar to what might be said to musicians or composers, that they have to have themselves relationships so that the creator is the brand, that the listenership or the readership is connected to.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you gotta have a way to communicate with the reader and the potential reader, the listener, and that might be your website, it might be Facebook, it might be by collaborating with other writers whose audience might be interested in what you do, in much the same way as me writing an article for New Music Box led to me talking to you now. This is using the content as bait.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's actually underexplored, and that is the ways that writers can work together to mutualize their audiences. I think that actually is a really interesting idea. Let me ask you one other thing. You mentioned, so I think I understood this, but I wanted to make sure I did, and that is you talked about each genre having the same, I guess I would call it the same shape. And maybe you could explain what you meant there. I think I understood that, but I want to make sure that I do.
Right. So this is the question I was slightly dreading, as it it calls upon me to explain verbally something that is on the very limit of my understanding of mathematics. But this idea of a long tail is based on a probability distribution. So for every, it might be in a store or a market, there are 10 records that sell 1,000 a week for every one record that sells 10,000 a week. And for every 10 records that sell 10,000 a week, there's one that sells 100,000 a week. And so, that shape is, at least within the music markets that I've analyzed genre by genre, that shape is the same across all genres in each store that I've looked at.
Right, so the hockey stick. Do you know what a hockey stick looks
like?
Yeah,
the hockey stick.
So it's the hockey stick.
The hockey stick's the same shape.
Right.
So classical music is not more hit-dominated than country or bubblegum pop or hip-hop or alternative rock. The hits account for exactly the same proportion of sales. It doesn't necessarily mean that hits come and go faster or slower. If you look at the sort of bubblegum pop chart, changes weekly. The country chart changes much more slowly. But the proportion of sales made up by the top sellers is the same across them all. So in classical music, this is an important thing to point out, because so often I hear people saying, oh, it's a long tail business, and you know, it doesn't really matter that we're not doing so well. It doesn't matter that we didn't chart. It doesn't matter that we didn't sell 1,000 copies in week one. And the truth is, of course, you can't obsess about how everybody else is doing, and you shouldn't compare your success to theirs. You have to compare your success against your goals and your budget. But it's not an excuse. It's not a good excuse for a classical artist to say, well, you know, it doesn't matter if I don't chart. That's not what it's about. It's possible to have a record that sells really well. It is as important in little genres as it is in big ones to be a standout success and to aim high.
Right. I think that I took from what you said that, and I think this is important for people thinking about books as well, that you don't want to aim to be in the long tail, because the long tail is pretty slow, and it you don't want to let that be an excuse either. I think you have to, although there is one difference I think between books and music, and that is the chart idea that you refer to, you know, where being on the chart is really the measure, I think is less important for books simply because there are so many more books. We might have the same shape of a fractal distribution. I think it probably is slightly different insofar as just that there are so many more books published annually that you can be in a good sales position for your business and never reach any kind of a measurable chart, because there, you know, there's just too many books to be in that top 100 or even top 500. But I still think you're right that the top 500 or the top 100 or the top 10 still accounts for an increasing percentage of the business on a radical basis. And probably what we've seen, at least in digital, is that's increased, that the sales per unit of the largest selling books is higher today than it ever was before, partially because of the ease with which digital can be, the word can be spread, and also because of the huge amount of choice, the limit to the number of things that can be on display means that the things that are on display will sell infinitely better than the things that are invisible.
Right, well, and there's when we all rushed out and bought our copy of The Long Tail and became convinced that we could become millionaires by selling things that barely anybody wanted, around that time there was this notion that this was possible. But today, what we realize about the internet is it didn't just make it possible to keep a massive inventory available for sale, but it also creates this kind of curation vacuum where people need to know which thing to buy. And technology has, as a result of that, or partly as a result of that, technology has created this tremendous cumulative advantage where the thing that gets ahead a little bit gets all the advantage. It shows up in search sooner. It gets recommended to people. The snowball starts to form, and that one gets bigger and bigger and bigger, while the other gets completely forgotten. So relatively little things at the beginning of your sales cycle can have a huge impact later on, because you weren't the one that snowballed. And we see this in music all the time, where people release basically identical products, particularly when they're marketing catalog. You get the same records released by two different labels, and you can watch how the two products go. They've got the same number of tracks, they're the same price, they've got basically the same things on the cover. You know, everyone's put out a 4th of July record. How's this going to do? And once somebody's in the lead, they win. And this is the less spoken of counterpart to the long tail, which is that the winner takes it all.
Yes. No. And let me ask you: are in your business, knowing that, do you play to that when you market?
Oh yes. Oh yes. And this is, I hesitate talking about some of the things that I do because I think I'm the only person who's thought of doing them. But especially when you're doing something that has very close competition in the market, it becomes very important to secure an early lead in the charts, to get the ball rolling as fast as possible.
So
from the very outset,
is there an equivalent in books? And I know there are certain, especially in digital, there are a couple of people who I've read. Usually, they don't come from the traditional book business; they've come from other businesses, and they've applied some rules that they've learned in maybe what are more commercial and take no prisoners kinds of businesses, recognizing this phenomenon that we've just been talking about. They've said to authors or to publishers, you need to be high in the chart. You need to try to get to number one on Amazon in your category because of the visibility factor. That once you're in the chart, as you've described, you become logarithmically more visible to people.
Oh yeah, yeah, and this is why in music you see the phenomenon of people buying copies of their own records.
Exactly, that's just what I was going to get to ask. There are a couple of businesses that I'm aware of. There probably are more that I'm not aware of because they've done a good job of hiding it. Who will offer because Amazon, by the way, has figured this out, Barnes & Noble as well. They know that it's too easy to manipulate these results if you have deep enough pockets. It's actually cheaper to buy your own product than it is to market and to buy advertising. So a lot of people have done this, and so the games, retailers have tried to. They've learned the pattern. They discount some of that behavior. They don't, like, if you bought 5,000 copies tomorrow of your new book, it won't show up number one because that sale will be looked at as an outlier, not real. It's impossible for it to count. Even if it was a legitimate sale, it won't be counted.
Right, but it might be quite sensible to combine all the email lists that you're going to hit and hit all of those lists at the same time.
Correct.
At the right time of day.
Yep.
on your release day. Or at least,
that's right.
At least time several of your marketing hits to coincide with each other. So when you know that your piece on All Things Considered is going out, you're also going to email everybody.
And at the same time, you might even buy AdWords at that same day and time and use some, if you can afford it, use some of the key terms that would drive traffic. You don't care if it goes to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It doesn't have to go to you because
it has to go somewhere.
It has to go somewhere where someone can act on it. And the other thing that I've seen people do is offer essentially a reward. If you will buy my book on this day at this time, I will give you I'll give you a rebate on the sale. You send me the proof of purchase, I'll write you a check. And I think that is a more, let's say, overt form of forcing the market to do what you want it to do. But I've seen that being done. And I've seen it happen also with, it's very similar to infomercial marketing, where you really don't care about the profitability of those first sales. What matters is building enough momentum that you can use the sales that you get to finance more and more marketing and more underwriting of the market so that eventually you can reap the reward down the road.
Right. Right, you lose a dollar on every sale and make it up in volume.
Yeah, Well, you do, and you make it up in volume in a different way. I mean, obviously, you can't lose a dollar on every sale forever, but you can lose a dollar on every sale until you reach the point where you can then convert.
Yes, although this can become a game of chicken.
Yeah,
and you may discover at the moment you decide to up your price to something economical. To increase your margin and begin recouping, you may discover that you've already sold to everybody that was going to buy your product.
Yeah, that is what. Yes, that is. Although in commercial, large scale commercial marketing, and it may not be true for books and records and more the entertainment products that we are involved with, because they don't have unlimited markets. But in many of those worlds, they feel like there is almost no limit because.
Oh yeah, and I think this is something that's important to remember. You know, I work in classical music, where my last label I was working at Naxos. We would make a record if we thought we could sell 3,000 copies of it. That's 3,000 copies to among 6 billion people.
Right. It does. Yeah, I know that it gives you a perspective to know that.
And you got to think about market saturation for music. The most popular records of all time have sold 150, 160 million units. Yeah, I think worldwide in total, the proportion of people who bought Thriller, which I think is currently the best-selling record of all time, is 1 in 62 people.
Right.
That means for everyone that owns it, there's 61 people who have yet to buy it.
Right, which you could look at as a really good opportunity.
Yeah, I worked this out one week. Katy Perry was at number one, and that week, 1 in 1,600 Americans had bought her album. You know, that's what number one is.
Right.
That's less than a percent.
Yeah, and I think for books, it's even lower. The best-selling book, it does sell, I think, far fewer copies than the best-selling music. So, and I know also you could compare us to television or, look at the number of people who watch television to the number of people who read. Obviously, not a fair comparison because television is mostly free to view, whereas almost all of the other entertainments require you to pay something. Well, let me ask you I do want to ask you one more thing because before we go, and this is the last thing you talked about, which I thought was really important also about making a budget. And I think you were pointing at art, as you call them, artist-led recording, which might apply to self-publishing authors, but probably does also still apply to some publishers who I would say, while they do budgeting, where they often run into trouble is in being unrealistic about the revenue side. It's even the smart publisher is going to be more let's say optimistic about their sales than they could be. But maybe you could talk a little bit just about what you see in the music side with this failure to understand how budgets work.
Okay, well, I mean, if I talk about what I see in the music industry, it's not going to be a particularly sophisticated conversation about the details of budgeting. Usually what's happened is people come to me and they say, we'd like to put this record out, and I'll say to them, okay, how far along the process are you? And they say, well, we've made the record. And I'll say, great, how much did it cost, and how many copies are you planning to sell? And if they know how much it cost at all, then that decision will have been made invariably without reference to how many copies of the record they think they can sell or how much money they think they're going to make on each unit. And it's worth remembering, of course, that whether it's publishing or music, the the products that don't recoup, the projects that don't recoup, have to be paid for by the ones that do. So you need a significant margin. You need some money left over on the things that go well if you're going to enter into any sort of commercial publishing operation. When you're making a record, the costs can spiral out of control very quickly. Because you're paying for studios, and you're paying for producers and engineers, and you're hiring musicians, and there are union rates, and if you don't realize that you can't spend that much money, then you end up paying list price for everything, without realizing that actually the only way these things get done a lot of the time is by cutting some sort of a deal and eliminating many of these costs. And then at the other end, you want to work out how much you're going to make per unit. And with music, I have my standard set of assumptions there on what the consumer's going to pay, so what the wholesale price is going to be, what the distributor's going to take, what you're going to have to pay in mechanical copyright, what it's going to cost to press the thing, and what's left over has to cover your overheads and leave you with your profit margin. And often that little bit that's left over is not very big at all.
I think we say the same things. I think the other thing that people often forget when they do their cost analysis, they will do a division of the number of units produced into their cost, and they'll say, okay, each book that I printed or each CD that I pressed cost me, let's say, $2.50. And so I can break even if I, and I add your sunk costs, and I can break even if I sell 4,000 or 3,000 copies. But that what they forget is that if you produce 5,000 in order, and your break even is 3,500, but of the 5,000 in the end you only sell 2,500. You have all of the cost of the unsold goods is added back to the cost of the sold goods, and
that eats your whole margin easily.
Yeah.
Now with music, overstock is not too scary. CDs can be pressed very quickly. You can request relatively short runs. You can order 300 or 500 more copies if you need them.
Yeah, that's a much bigger that is a huge
amount of inventory.
Yeah, that's a huge benefit. I think that the digital short run printing has helped that in publishing, but it's because the cost differential is very. It's significant. You know, if I produce 5,000, my unit cost is very low compared to producing 500. So,
the thing we have to look at then, once we've understood the economics of physical production and distribution, in drawing up our budget, this is before we've recorded the thing, maybe after we've written the book, but certainly before we've committed ourselves to publishing it, we have to look at the various ways in which we could bring this to market and look at the financial outcomes of all of them and say, okay, so if I do a short run pressing myself and I sell this directly to the consumers because I have to do all this extra work, but I make a much more margin, maybe I can personally reach the 500 people it will take to recoup. Whereas if I go to a publisher or a distributor and I give up massive chunk of my margin to bring this to the market, then sure, these people with the marketing they do are going to reach a bigger audience, but they need to reach a bigger audience. How much bigger is that audience? I mean, you know, what if I just do a digital thing or some mixture of a digital thing and a short run without mainstream distribution? What I tend to find with music is there's this gap where it kind of makes sense to do it yourself, to do every part of it yourself and deal with your own fans for 500,000, 2,000, 3,000 copies. But really, although I said earlier that Naxos would put out a CD if they thought they could sell 3,000 copies of it, that's assuming they didn't have to pay anything to make it, any production costs have to come out of additional sales. With a record, really, if I'm going to be looking for international distribution, suddenly I've got to sell 15,000 copies of it. And so there's this gap around the kind of selling more than 5,000. It's very difficult to sell 5,000 copies of a record yourself at your gigs, up to 10,000-15,000, where it's extremely difficult to make that work economically, and it takes a degree of financial risk that some artists most artists are not happy taking on, and which isn't hugely likely to pay off. But you've got to think about why you're doing this in the first place as well. You know, are you doing this to make money? In which case, often the direct-to-fan thing is the most profitable, low-risk option. And if you're doing it to reach new fans, then selling it to your existing fans is not going to do anything for you at all. So then you're willing to make no money in order to have your label, your distributor, take on all this marketing. And really, a thorough examination of what your goals are in doing this will inform the decisions you make with the budget you make. And not having an honest appreciation of those goals is fatal. I see that a lot.
I think that's something that's also very, very similar in the book business. Well, listen, Andy, I really appreciate your taking so much time to talk to me. This has been really interesting. I hope interesting for you to get a chance to talk a little bit in this other context, but I've really enjoyed it and want to thank you. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Andy Doe about the music business and the book business together. Thank you.